The mystery behind a chilling video, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In a video, you see soldiers leading two women and their children down a dirt path.
There's a point where one of the soldiers sort of tells this child that, sorry, we have to do this kind of thing, and basically saying it's your parents' fault that you're getting killed as well.
But no one knew where this atrocity took place until a team of reporters figured it out using Google Earth. Plus, a government rule change that could force immigrant parents to make a difficult choice.
Either keep yourself and your children healthy, but risk being separated for using Medicaid or SNAP, or forego those vital services so your family can remain together in this country.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. It's good to have you with us. I saw a great T-shirt this weekend as I was strolling through MIT. It said, "Science, it's gotten us this far." Funny and a great way to introduce our science theme coming up for the next few minutes. We're going to hear about the crucial relationship between the Amazon rainforest and global climate. We're also going to look at the challenges in developing tsunami warning systems around the globe. And we start with the latest from Indonesia. As you've probably heard, more than 800 people were killed on the island of Sulawesi after a major earthquake on Friday triggered a tsunami. A lot of the destruction happened in the city of Palu, located at the end of a narrow bay. Talib Bawano is with a team of volunteers searching for people trapped beneath the rubble of a hotel and shopping mall.
We rescued three people. We also heard several others asking for help, including a child. But those people are still there. It must be very dark down there. There's no light. And all we could do is give them motivation and encouragement. We did give some of these survivors water and food, but that's not what they wanted. They wanted to get out. We heard many of them screaming, "We want to get out! Out! Help! Help!" But some were just knocking.
Food and water are in short supply. There's also been looting. This woman spoke to a reporter near a looted supermarket in Palu.
The situation forced us to do this. We need everything, food, water. We took anything we could take. We can't even cook, so that's why we looted.
The situation could be even worse in more remote areas on the island of Sulawesi. And Indonesian officials are warning that the death toll from this disaster could still grow a lot. My BBC colleague Rebecca Henschke is in Palu.
President Joko Widodo has visited the area, promising to speed up the aid operation, and hundreds of military personnel have been deployed. Now some of the most vulnerable are getting help, but those left behind are struggling. With aid only now just trickling in, desperate residents are taking matters into their own hands.
There's been no aid. We need to eat. We don't have any other choice. We must get food.
We're in a crisis. We have nothing for our basic needs. Food, water, we desperately need them.
Desperate relatives are flocking to the area to try and find out the fate of loved ones. This lady hasn't heard from her son and daughter since the quake hit.
I'm going out of my mind. I don't know where my children are. I'm going crazy with worry about them. I have no news at all.
With aftershocks continuing to be felt, frightened survivors here are spending another night out in the open.
The BBC's Rebecca Henschke reporting there from Palu, Indonesia. The disaster on the island of Sulawesi is still unfolding, and the focus now for officials there is rightly finding survivors and getting aid to those in need. But there's a science and technology question that hangs over this tragedy. Why wasn't there more warning for people in the path of that tsunami? Indonesia has a system of 22 buoys equipped with sensors, and they're supposed to warn if a tsunami is coming, but the buoys haven't worked for 6 years. Indonesia is developing a new early warning system that might have raised the alarm, but that one is still just a prototype. We wanted to know more about these tsunami early warning systems, so we reached out to Kenan Ball. Kenan, you're an engineer at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution here in Massachusetts, and you were part of the team that installed this new tsunami warning system in the waters off of Indonesia. How would your system have worked?
Well, the way our system would have worked is slightly different than the system that's already out there. The existing system has a buoy that's on the surface of the ocean. There's sensors that hang below it, and then it's tethered to the ocean bottom. Our system would have no buoy on the surface. It would be a sensor mounted down on the ocean bottom, and as a tsunami wave would pass over top of it, it would send a signal back to shore underwater via sound. A cabled infrastructure from the shore would receive that signal, and then it would send an alert to let people know that a tsunami wave was coming.
And what kind of time elapses between the sensors in your system noticing this event and the time at which people on shore have a moment to escape?
My understanding from the early research in prototypes phase of this system was supposed to be able to provide on the order of maybe 20 to 25 to 30 minutes of warning, based on the idea that the sensor is mounted in the center of the basin in those areas.
So can you tell us how your system is different from the system that failed to work?
The main difference between our system and those systems is the lack of buoy that's on the surface, things that can get vandalized, things that can be damaged in heavy seas. And additionally, our system communicates remotely to the shore via acoustic signals.
You mentioned vandalism. I mean, that was a problem with the system that failed to work. Weren't a lot of the buoys just stolen?
I don't know the specifics, but in the early days of discussing making these new prototype systems, that was one of the concerns, is that the systems had been vandalized.
Yeah. So your prototype is on the seafloor, but it's more than 1,000 miles from where the Sulawesi tsunami struck and the epicenter of the quake. How helpful would it have been on Friday?
Well, that particular system may not have been helpful, but in the larger picture of the program, rather than there just being one sensor on the ocean bottom, there would be multiple sensors on the ocean bottom. And they could be in very strategic locations around the area. And then each one of those, if they made a measurement, or multiples if they made a measurement, could send that information back to shore acoustically.
So there have been at least 10 tsunamis to have hit Indonesia this century so far. I mean, the death toll is up in the thousands. What would it take to get your system up and running to be able to alert people throughout the region?
It's just a matter of time and having the local governments install the appropriate infrastructure. At the moment, we're waiting for the next phase of testing to take place over in Indonesia, I think in the spring, to which the Indonesian government is installing this cabled infrastructure.
Keenan Ball with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Thanks very much for your time today.
Yeah, no problem.
Now to a different subject of scientific research, the health of the Amazon rainforest in South America. The fate of the forest is intertwined with that of the indigenous people who live there and of the animal species in the forest. It's no exaggeration to say that the Amazon is also tied to the future of the world's climate. This week on The World, we're going to explain why the Amazon is even more consequential than ever. Reporter Sam Eaton traveled there recently for us and our partners at The Nation magazine and PBS NewsHour. Sam joins us now here in our Boston studios. So, Sam, what does the future of the Amazon have to do with the future of the climate?
Yeah, Marco, often we hear of the Amazon for its incredible biodiversity. Less often and more so, actually, you're hearing about the role of the Amazon in the climate. A lot of times people call it the lungs of the planet, but actually the metaphor is kind of funny because it's in reverse. It's absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. As the trees grow, as photosynthesis happens, it absorbs CO2. So it's this immense carbon store for the planet, providing this incredible service for us. The idea for this series of stories that we're going to be running this week on The World came up about a year ago when Science Magazine published probably the most important and least noticed climate paper in years. Scientists from Woods Hole Research Center and Boston University found that tropical forests in the Amazon and around the world have been so degraded by logging and burning of the forest and agriculture that they're actually releasing more carbon into the atmosphere than they're storing. This flipping of these carbon sinks to carbon sources has huge implications for the planet. Carlos Quesada is one of the researchers studying this carbon cycle down in the Amazon. This is what he had to say.
If the Amazon, which is the biggest tropical forest in the world, stops doing this environmental service of sequestrating carbon from the atmosphere, the idea is that it will all accumulate in the atmosphere, and CO2 will show a greater increment than it has been showing so far.
Sam, what did de Quesada mean when he said greater increment?
Basically, he says that we're going to see higher CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. The Amazon used to be taking something like all of the emissions from all the cars on the planet and absorbing it into the forest. That's not happening anymore.
So, Sam, tell us where you went in this very large forest in South America, and who did you talk to?
Yeah, we're talking about a forest that's the size of the lower 48 United States, so a massive wow. area. And the idea was to go to the what's called the Arc of Deforestation. This is where the agricultural frontier is basically chewing away at the edges of the Amazon. And we wanted to talk to as many of the players. So you have basically logging on the front end, then you have cattle ranching, and then you have these agriculture kind of coming in on the tail end, these massive soy farms. And the idea was to talk to as many of these players as possible and piece together all of these complex elements that are behind the rising deforestation rates in the Amazon right now.
So if the metaphor is, as you said earlier, the lungs of the world are no longer inhaling like they used to, they're now coughing, what is your take from this whole set of stories that we're going to hear?
I mean, I think the biggest takeaway from this is that there's no clear villain. It's not just, you know, the illegal loggers going in. We need to stop the bulldozers. It's all of us, essentially. So if you're eating beef, if you're eating other meat that is fed soy that comes from the Brazilian Amazon, if you're building a deck that has ipé, which is one of the highest value hardwoods coming from the rainforest, you know, this is affecting the future of the Amazon forest. And this is something that affects all of us, because if we are going to meet the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement, it's not going to happen without these forests. We actually need to be growing more trees, not cutting them down.
Yeah, and that list you just went down, from burgers to hardwood like ipé from the Amazon, will give a lot of Americans pause. So not very encouraging picture, and with serious consequences. What hope is there? Any glimmers?
Yeah, and this was a big focus of our reporting. There's a lot of energy happening down there around indigenous entrepreneurs, small farmers, people that are trying to create a standing forest economy. How do you value the forest economically more so than cutting it down, as a way to kind of get away this duality of conservation on one side and extraction on the other, which is a very much, you know, a losing game as it's been. Another glimmer of hope are the indigenous groups that are protecting their forests. And this is one of the best protections they've found. Scientists have documented this, that indigenous groups who have clear land rights and titles to their land, this is one of the best protections against deforestation. So I spent a lot of time with these indigenous groups that have basically taken, you know, protecting their forests into their own hands. They've organized these vigilante militias that patrol their lands to keep the constant pressure of illegal logging out of their lands. They've also taken the fight to Brasilia to protest what's happening politically, which is rolling back a lot of these indigenous rights so that you can open up their lands to mining and agriculture. And one of the organizers of an event that I was there, where it was like 3,000 indigenous people from 100 different groups showed up in Brasilia and protested. They marched. Sonia Guajajara is one of the main organizers of that. She's also a vice presidential candidate in the upcoming election. And this is what she had to say.
Povos indígenas, né, resistem para poder existir.
So she's saying the indigenous people have basically been fighting these forces for millennia, and she's saying that the fight is for forests that benefit not just the indigenous people, but all of humanity. So this is not just their cause, it's everyone's.
The lungs of the planet, the Amazon. Reporter Sam Eaton, looking forward to your stories this week, and that starts tomorrow here in the world. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, Marco.
Coming up, the story about a video that shows soldiers committing a crime, but no one knew where the crime took place or who the soldiers were. Enter satellite imagery and an enterprising team of investigative reporters. That story after the break, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Our next story is not, strictly speaking, about science, but it is about how the science behind Google Earth and satellite imagery helped advance the investigation into an atrocity committed a few years ago. More on the science and the investigation in a moment. First, a warning that you're about to hear some graphic details in this story. A story that begins, as I said, with an atrocity. This is a moment from a video that went viral this summer. In it, a killing is about to take place. Soldiers are walking two prisoners down a road. You can just about hear one of the soldiers whistling while a comrade is filming and commenting.
Pendant l'assaut, il en a le deuxième classe cobra.
The prisoners are two women, plus a young child and a baby. 22 shots were fired in all. The women and the children were killed. But it was unclear who was shooting or where this happened. At first glance, a guess might be that it's somewhere in Africa, but that's about it. Then a team from the BBC's Africa Eye investigative unit went to work. And thanks to science and technology, they managed to zero in on not just where these killings happened, but also the identity of the likely shooters. Those alleged shooters are now in custody. Tommy Oladipo is the BBC Africa security correspondent, joins us from Nairobi. A really outstanding piece of investigative journalism, Tommy. What made you and the team think you could actually crack this case?
Well, I think first of all, it was just the shock that gripped everyone who saw this video right from the beginning. And it began, you know, just conversations across Twitter. There were different researchers reaching out and saying, does anybody know where this is? Does anybody have any idea what this terrain links to? And that's how the conversation started, and lots of people talking, and then the BBC picked up on it and became a full-on investigation.
I mean, I guess the first challenge was to figure out what country this happened in, and then getting more specific details about where in that country. How did you figure out the location? What role did open source technology play in that?
Well, I mean, part of this whole collaboration, first of all, looking at that, that could be anywhere in the Sahel, which is right across West and Central Africa. But with many heads put together, one of them was Amnesty International, the rights group, which had been researching Northern Cameroon and about the military there. And, you know, also when you listen to the video and, you know, looking at the uniforms, listening to some of the dialogue in it, and Amnesty with their research as well, they suggested this was Cameroon, this was Northern Cameroon. Of course, that's also a vast region. But over time, trying to match the topography, as you can see in the video, there are certain distinct outlines of the mountains in the video, and using those ridge lines, matching them to Google Earth and Digital Globe and other imagery providers, using geolocation, that's how, you know, this all moved on, and the location was matched.
I found that part a little bit difficult to kind of understand, and how you were able to know that that ridgeline matched the contours of what you found on GPS. I mean, that's the only ridgeline that has that shape in all of Cameroon?
It's painstaking work. It's not something that was very easy. But there were so many clues put together. So it's not just the ridgeline. It could be any ridgeline. But when you have one clue and you have another clue, you sort of bring them together, and that narrows the results you get. So, for example, looking at different times, for example, when certain buildings existed versus when they did not. So going back in time and looking at different elements of that and adding everything together. So it's something that took quite a bit of time and more than a dozen people working on it.
Yeah, and you also worked with Bellingcat, the open source research group, which is seriously experienced in this kind of stuff. How did you figure out who was responsible?
Well, first of all, the government tried to deny initially that these were Cameroonian soldiers. They said, you know, the uniform worn was not what their soldiers would wear up north. They said the guns are not the ones issued to Cameroonian soldiers. But we did identify some of the guns. One of them is a Zastava M21, which is used by some divisions of the Cameroonian army. We also found some of the uniforms were indeed Cameroonian military uniforms. And so we were able to first of all identify and confirm that those were Cameroonian soldiers. But then in the dialogue as well, some of the soldiers were saying each other's names. One of them was referred to as Chocho. Another one was called Sanga. But around the same time, before the BBC investigation came out, the Cameroonian government actually arrested seven soldiers. So they changed their tone and said, well, they had arrested certain people in relation to this video. And from the BBC's own investigation, we're able to match these names that were mentioned in the video to some of the ones that were arrested. And some of those names were nicknames, but on the official list, they had the official names. And so we could match that. We could use Facebook as well to match some of those details.
Yeah, you found part of the painstaking Chocho work. You found Chocho on Facebook, right?
Yes, indeed. That's the nickname of a soldier called Siriak Bitiala. And apart from just his Facebook, you know, we found we're able to speak to a former Cameroonian soldier who also confirmed that this was indeed Chocho, so somebody who knew him.
Have you been able to find out, and the team been able to find out, any possible motive for this violent crime? Two women, two children, including a baby.
At the beginning of the video, we see them referring to these women as Boko Haram, so saying that they are members or at least affiliated with Boko Haram. And there's a point where one of the soldiers sort of tells this child that, you know, sorry, we have to do this kind of thing, and basically saying it's your parents' fault that you're getting killed as well. So, you know, the soldiers are not affording these women and children any access to a fair trial. They just, you know, execute what they consider justice on the spot.
Yeah, I guess we'll see how many crimes like this are invisible. What kind of feedback to this investigation has BBC Africa gotten from the public, like from Cameroon and Nigeria itself?
The feedback has been overwhelming, and people of all walks of life from around the world responding to this and saying, you know, well done on the work. But I think one thing that people are most fascinated by is the method, you know, the geolocation, the use of mathematical calculations, calculating, for example, you know, the angle of the sun and using that versus the length of a shadow and using that to tell what time, when exactly this happened. So those kinds of things have really fired up the audiences. So there's been a lot of praise for that and a lot of people hoping that more can come out. Cameroonian people in particular have been calling for more to be done to hold their government and their forces accountable.
The video, you have to say, is very disturbing. How are you doing and the others on the investigative team?
It's not an easy video to watch. You know, it's difficult to, you know, once you've seen it, first of all, to even believe that that's happened and the shock, and it's something you can't really erase from your mind. So it's not something easy to watch, but it is a necessary job to be done to when you have to expose these kinds of things. There are lots of atrocities around the world. Sometimes you have to go the hard way to be able to get to the depths of these things and expose them.
That's my colleague, Tommy Oladipo, the BBC's Africa security correspondent. Tommy, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Coming up on The World, a new reality TV show lets six white people live in native communities for a month. It's supposed to promote love and understanding between cultures, but it's having the opposite effect.
We don't feel that we need a refresher in white people's racism towards indigenous people.
That story is still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The United States, Canada, and Mexico have come to a last-minute agreement to update the North American Free Trade Agreement. Just don't call it NAFTA 2.0.
Called USMCA. It sort of just works. MCA.
President Trump at the White House today. USMCA is short for the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. Kind of flows off the tongue. Joining me now in the studio is The World's Jason Margolis. Could have been a riff on Kanye. You know, he abbreviated that to yay, and right. NAFTA could have been ta.
Possibly, yes.
Missed opportunity. Jason, you've been writing about NAFTA for a long time now. How are people reacting to this new NAFTA, this USMCA?
Right. Well, there's the politics, and then there's the economic side of it. And the quick political reaction is from President Trump. We had the worst deal in the history of the world, and now it's the greatest deal in the history of the world.
This landmark agreement will send cash and jobs pouring into the United States and into North America, good for Canada, good for Mexico. Instead of jobs leaving for overseas, they will be returning back home, and we've already had it.
And the truth is, what was agreed to yesterday is not a radically different trade agreement from NAFTA. It's an updated deal. So it's a bit like saying, I have a baseball team. I got rid of a couple players. It was the worst team ever. Now it's the best team ever. So when you look at the economics, it's not a radical overhaul. It updates things.
Jason, when you come right down to it, what's really different about USMCA from NAFTA?
So there are some changes to some key industries. For example, autos now requires that 75% of a car must be made in North America, Canada, the U.S., or Mexico in order to qualify for no tariffs under the new deal, the USMCA. It doesn't quite flow off my tongue yet.
Right.
One of the things that's gotten a lot of attention is U.S. dairy farmers will have more access to the Canadian markets. Canadian dairy farmers are not happy about that. They feel they've been used as a political pawn. This is David Weens. He's the vice president of the Dairy Farmers of Canada, and this is what he had to say.
Today, the message sent to our passionate, proud, and quality-conscious people is clear. They are nothing more than a bargaining chip to satisfy President Trump.
Yeah, so Canadian dairy farmers not happy. Can President Trump count this accurately as a big political win?
I think so. It does bring NAFTA into the 21st century. It addresses intellectual property, the age of digitization. I mean, this was passed in the early 90s, so it does update things. But also keep this in mind. I spoke with Jason Furman, who served as President Obama's chief on the Council of Economic Advisers. He said, yeah, this is great that we have some certainty and things are moving forward. But all these things were negotiated under an updated Trans-Pacific Partnership. Not all these things. Most of these things were updated. This is what Furman told me this morning.
A lot of this is getting things back that Canada had already agreed to in another agreement 2 years ago.
What happens now? When does this deal become real?
So the easy part is done, getting the three leaders of these countries to reach an agreement and their trade representatives. Now comes the hard part. And here's President Trump speaking today at the White House.
And I plan to sign the agreement by the end of November. I then will submit it for approval to Congress, where in theory there should be no trouble. But anything you submit to Congress is trouble, no matter what. It's the single greatest agreement ever signed. They'll say, well, you know, Trump likes it, therefore we're not going to approve it, because that would be good for the Republicans, so therefore we can't approve it.
It does strike me, though, that the Republicans will still be in control of Congress at the end of November.
They will, but this will probably bleed into next year. And remember, a lot of Democrats were with President Trump on this issue. They wanted NAFTA to be updated. They felt it was very unfair to labor. They wanted environmental provisions. And I have not read through this entire revision, nor have my sources. This is 36 chapters, and each chapter is 10 to 20 pages. So it's going to take many weeks to digest this, and little parts are going to be coming out. Like, how did the Florida tomato growers fare? How did the avocado growers fare? How did this industry fare? How did that industry? We don't really know the nitty-gritty. And remember, with all trade deals, there are winners and losers, and there's going to be people in Canada, the U.S., and Mexico who say, yes, I really came out well in this. I came out ahead. And other people saying, you did what? You did what to my industry? So that's going to be coming out in the next few weeks.
Yeah, we'll have to see the details. The World's Jason Margolis telling us about the new NAFTA known as the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. Thanks very much, Jason.
Thanks, Marco.
The Trump administration's treatment of undocumented migrant children is in the news again. Over the weekend, the New York Times published a report about a tent city in West Texas where many of these children are now being held. This tent city in the town of Tornillo, Texas, has been massively expanded, and hundreds of immigrant minors have reportedly been ferried there from shelters elsewhere in the country in the middle of the night. One important note, these are not the same kids who were separated from their parents at the border early in the summer. Some of them are still being held and processed by the government. This is a different population. These minors in the West Texas camp are mainly teenagers who were detained after trying to enter the country by themselves. Leah Chavla is an attorney with the Women's Refugee Commission.
The tent camp is, you know, pretty remote. It's very far from El Paso, which I think is the closest city. There's not a lot of vegetation. It's just, you know, I think the pictures really speak for themselves. There's rows and rows of those tents that are the children's living quarters. They have a couple other facilities on site, you know, dining facilities and the like. But it is remote, and it feels like you're kind of in the middle of the desert.
I know that you at the Women's Refugee Commission have concerns that this large-scale camp makes kids more vulnerable. Can you elaborate on that? How does it do that?
You know, let's say that a child was moved from a facility where there were maybe 30 beds, capacity for 30 children. So it's much more of a homey environment. They have access to education, so they'll receive some kind of classroom instruction and basic subjects. They'll learn some English. They'll also have regular attention. They'll have regular access to medical care, to mental health support, psychologists. A lot of these children are suffering, or may have experienced some kind of trauma, either in home country is the reason for for leaving and or possibly en route. And so it's very important that these children have, you know, the attention that they need and the access that they need too. And so I think in a big facility, when we turn to these big facilities like Tornillo, this emergency facility, we see that, you know, there isn't the same provision for education. The kids, you know, we were told the kids get workbooks, but that's not education. Yeah, it's not a far cry from classroom education. And in terms of any kinds of mental health care, you know, emotional support, anything along those lines, it's really ad hoc. It's really the onus is then on the child to ask for it. But, you know, they've just been transitioned there from a different facility. They don't know anyone. They're disoriented. You know, they're possibly upset about it. And so I think it's really difficult in those situations, coupled with being with thousands of kids, you know, hundreds of other kids. It's quite destabilizing.
Yeah, and then the mind kind of boggles when you think about 13 to 17-year-olds and what they're thinking legally. I mean, mm-hmm. Do they have any legal help that they can access?
Well, that's a great question. So, you know, it doesn't happen at every facility, but, you know, by and large, children at the permanent shelters are provided with, Know Your Rights presentation. They receive screenings. And so in some cases, some of the children are able to get some legal support through those avenues. You know, because the children are transferred from other facilities to Tornillo, you know, my understanding is that they're not receiving any more Know Your Rights at Tornillo, at the tent camp facility. And, you know, the access to legal services there has been very difficult. So, again, it is concerning.
Meantime, the administration and its supporters say the immigration system is broken and Congress needs to fix it. How do you respond to that?
Sure. I mean, I think we have a system. We have a protection system in place. A lot of these kids are seeking protection in this country. We have that in place. You know, could it improve? Sure. I think what's really missing is investment in the system. There's a huge backload of cases. We need more immigration judges, more support staff for those judges. I mean, I think we need to really invest in the process instead of saying, oh, the process doesn't work because it's so slow, or, oh, the process doesn't work for other reasons. And so I think it's chronic lack of investing in a system. We need to prioritize getting children out of detention. It's just not appropriate for them. It's just not it's not a long-term, it's not a good solution. We need to get kids out of detention, and we need to continue to work on the immigration court system.
Are you hopeful?
Am I hopeful? You know, I am hopeful in the sense that I think I'm you know, the public is engaged on this issue. I think Congress has been very engaged in this issue, and, you know, doing a lot of visits, certainly, to different shelters, looking at this issue holistically from arrival to the immigration courts. And so I'm hopeful there's a lot of oversight on this right now. But obviously, it's one thing to have that versus, you know, commitment to funding, you know, and hiring more judges and, you know, to releasing children to appropriate and safe sponsors as soon as possible.
Leah Chavla is an attorney with the Women's Refugee Commission. Thank you for your time, Leah.
Thank you very much.
President Trump's crackdown on immigration has taken many forms over the past year and 9 months. One of the latest, a proposed rule change regarding how the U.S. government decides whether someone is eligible for a visa or permanent residency. This change would essentially mean that anyone deemed to be at risk of becoming a public charge of the government by accessing government benefits like Medicaid or housing subsidies, for example, could be denied a visa or a green card. Advocates fear this could lead to families here in the U.S. doing without benefits or even medical care for fear of putting their legal status in jeopardy. Lanre Falusi says she's already seeing that happening. Falusi's a pediatrician in Washington and a spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics.
So this proposed rule is a vast expansion of what can be used against an immigrant who is applying for a visa or for a permanent residency. So what it does really, from my perspective as a pediatrician, is that it presents our immigrant families with an unfair choice. So either keep yourself and your children healthy, but risk being separated for using these services such as Medicaid or SNAP, also called food stamps, or forego those vital services that include healthcare and nutrition assistance so your family can remain together in this country. So really, this proposed rule is a dangerous threat to child and family health.
So the rule, obviously still in the proposal phase, but what chilling effects are you already seeing and hearing from families?
So I've been seeing the chilling effect for months already, with families deciding to disenroll from these vital services just in case it could be used against them in the future. This includes even opting out of programs, again, like SNAP and even WIC, or the Women, Infants, and Children program. And for months, parents have been asking us if it's safe for them to access these programs. And it's tough because it's a very complex proposal, the draft of which is nearly 450 pages. So parents are choosing to play it safe and remove themselves from programs that they qualify for. So it's a very confusing and scary time for the families I see.
I'm wondering if you can tell us about a specific conversation you've had recently with a family or a parent who is facing the dilemma you're talking about.
So I'd say that one of the many situations that trouble me in particular is that more and more I'm seeing new moms with newborns who are only a few days old choosing not to sign up for these services. So as recently as last week, I cared for a baby who was only 4 days old. And as with many new moms, the mom was motivated to breastfeed but was having a difficult time doing so. She was also concerned that her family was not able to afford fruits and vegetables and other healthy foods that are vital, especially for a breastfeeding mom. So as I usually do, I talked about the many benefits of federal programs that provide breastfeeding support or formula if needed or food assistance, but she declined. And she said that she'd heard that it could jeopardize her family's chances of staying together here in the U.S. So I worry about this baby and many babies in similar situations who are starting their lives without all of the support that they could get if their families were not being placed in the situation of fear and uncertainty. And that's one child that I saw last week, but so many others over the last several months that I've seen in that same situation.
So families, individuals are looking at the trade-off between access to medical care and possibly limiting their chances of getting permanent legal status.
Right. So they're being forced to decide between either stability in the U.S. with a new status or choosing their family's health, which is really an impossible choice. So the message that immigrant families are hearing is that they have to make that choice, either healthcare and food or seeking permanent legal status in the United States.
Right. And it's not just medical benefits that will be affected, right? I mean, it's a whole range of other benefits that could ultimately have an effect on people's health.
Right. Exactly. So with the programs that are affected include Medicaid, which really is a lifeline for a lot of my families. They would not be able to afford the preventive care, the specialty care, the dental care that all kids need if they didn't have Medicaid. It includes programs like SNAP or food stamps that provides healthy foods and includes housing assistance and other services that actually allow them to be healthy and stable so that they can contribute to the United States, to our economy, to our society.
Dr. Lanrai Falusi, a pediatrician in Washington with the Children's National Health System, also a spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's take a minute so you know about a remarkable story we'll have tomorrow. It's about a man named Jesse. He lives in California. He comes from a Mexican-American family. He's been incarcerated for half of his life. And he was told early on in prison not to mix with inmates who are not like him.
You know, we don't engage with them. We don't do business with them. And if you do, you're going to get in trouble. At least you're going to get beat up. At worst, you're going to get stabbed.
But that's not true in every prison. We go to one where change is happening, and inmates like Jesse are part of the change. That story coming up tomorrow. When I think of a reality TV show, I think of The Apprentice or The Real Housewives of fill in the blank. What I haven't seen yet is a reality TV show about indigenous communities that also aims to undo stereotypes about them. But that's exactly what some Canadians are watching now. Here's The World's Alison Herrera.
For those of you who watch Survivor, the plot to this Canadian reality TV show won't sound like anything new. Take a group of people, put them into unfamiliar situations, have them struggle, watch their reaction, hint, there will be crying, and then wait for the hugs and redemption. Here's the catch. The show, First Contact, which airs on the Aboriginal People's Television Network in Canada, aims to dismantle racist stereotypes white people have about Indigenous people.
They don't paint their houses. They don't fix windows.
Welfare's not a career.
They're angry at white people.
I mean, they want you to feel sorry for them.
The show focuses on six people who hold negative views towards Indigenous people. These same six people get a firsthand look at what life is like for Indigenous people in Canada. They witness some of the challenges these communities face, things like high rates of poverty, unemployment, and in general, just how excluded Indigenous people are from the advantages of living in one of the world's wealthiest countries.
Thanks for coming to my community.
I had no idea. It really puts a dark stain on the Canada that I thought I knew.
I came here with ignorant views, and you know what? I was wrong.
But the show has been criticized for putting Indigenous people in the position of having to educate white people about the issues they face.
We don't feel that we need a refresher in white people's racism towards Indigenous people.
That's Kim Tallbear. She teaches Native Studies at the University of Alberta in Canada.
They are trading on long-standing colonial tropes that most of us grew up with and that we find very hurtful to have to listen to.
The concept of the show isn't new. 3 years ago, a show with the same name aired in Australia.
You're going to get a sense of what it must be like to be an Aboriginal Australian. It's not going to be an easy journey.
And it provoked similar reactions among Indigenous people there. Tallbear says she doesn't understand why shows like this are being produced.
This is not made for Indigenous people, really. And even in that show, Indigenous people are not really the main characters of the show. They're sort of the foils against which white people get to act out their racism.
I completely understand it. And we know that there was a triggering element, but we felt that we really had to begin a dialogue.
That's Stephanie Scott. She's one of the producers of the Canadian version of First Contact. She says she's gotten a lot of positive feedback on the show from Native and non-Native viewers.
We had to start somewhere. It's just a small step. And no matter what you do, there's always going to be someone that, you know, has an issue with it. But generally, overwhelming response has been extremely positive.
But Kim Tallbear says there are better ways to learn about the lives of Indigenous people than by watching them on a reality TV show. That said, season two of First Contact is in the works. For The World, I'm Allison Herrera.
Finally today, it was as if Francis Frank Sinatra had died, they were saying today on French TV. And yes, the death of Sinatra is a pretty good way to frame the passing of Charles Aznavour at the age of 94.
Je suis triste. Et la France est triste, et le monde entier est triste. Il mérite pour moi des funérailles.
That's one of Aznavour's best-known collaborators, French singer Mireille Mathieu, saying today, France is sad, the whole world is sad. Mathieu said Aznavour deserves a state funeral, and she has a point. Aznavour's music first penetrated the French psyche in the 1950s when he got signed by the owner of the Moulin Rouge, who'd seen him perform in a casino in Morocco. Aznavour became famous with his title role in François Truffaut's Shoot the Piano Player, a part Truffaut wrote specifically for him. But above all, it was his music.
Montmartre en ce temps-là, accroché des lilas, jusque sous nos fenêtres, et si l'humble garni qui nous servait de nid, ne payait pas de mine. C'est là qu'on s'est connu, moi qui criais famine, et toi qui posais nu.
I sing to you of a time that the under-20s won't remember, goes that Aznavour classic, Bohème. Today, there is nostalgia in the songs of Charles Aznavour, but they were nostalgic when he first recorded them, a nostalgia for a simpler France that was, in the early 1960s, rapidly changing. As Aznavour said in an interview 2 years ago, he kept singing his songs in his 80s and 90s because he acknowledged a simple fact.
The fact of being very old. Mm-hmm. I'm not afraid by saying I'm old, I'm aging, because my public is aging with me.
That's right.
And that relaxes them. They are very happy to hear that somebody else have the same problems. And yet, it's not a problem for me. Mm.
There's another audience that appreciated Aznavour, Armenians. Aznavour was born Shanur Aznavourian in Paris to Armenian parents, both of them performers, who had fled Turkish oppression and landed in France. Armine Manukian grew up listening to Aznavour's music in Armenia. She's now the principal at the Armenian school around the corner from us in Watertown, Massachusetts, one of the largest Armenian communities in the U.S.
You know, I woke up first thing in the morning, and then I grabbed my phone and I got texts from my family members. I went to Facebook. It was bombarded with sadness, and people were writing how huge heroes for us. What a big loss this is for the Armenian community. And I will tell you that he helped Armenia not only financially, but politically. He was an advocating for positive changes for the homeland.
When a devastating earthquake struck Armenia in 1988, killing 45,000 people, Charles Aznavour immediately sprang to action with a song.
The first thing I remember was that song, For You Armenia song, that was performed by the celebrities all around the world to raise funds for the earthquake victims. Charles Aznavour was one of the first to jump to the rescue and to raise funds for the victims and the families in the earthquake regions. And I remember seeing big trucks of goods, food, and supplies constantly coming to Armenia through the Aznavour for Armenia Fund. And he was very close to his roots. He was always proud to call himself Armenia. And I would for sure say that Heaven Gate, one of our best.
Charles Aznavour sang for Armenians, he sang for the French, he sang for audiences around the globe. He even sang to puppets. Okay, technically Muppets.
Each world, measuring the marigolds, you and your arithmetic.
Charles Aznavour died in his sleep at the age of 94. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.